thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 75, for Friday, October 7th, 2011. The Kindle cracked. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. This will be episode 75. We are a skeleton crew today. I am Amanda French. I'm going to be your host today. I am that camp coordinator at the Center for History and New Media. And I'm joined by Tom Scheinfeldt, Managing Director of the Center for History and New Media. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Amanda.
How's the weather up where you are?
The weather is fine. Crisp, classic New England fall weather.
Love to hear it. We're also joined by Mills Kelly, who is heading up some important global affairs department or something, Mills. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. How's the weather over at that building?
Well, you know, the internal weather is terrible, but outside it looks pretty nice. You know, we have a nice artificial environment in here with the heat on in our building, even though it's like 70 degrees outside already. So we're sweating.
Okay. Well, I hope that is not metaphorical sweat.
No, it's the real drippy kind.
Okay, good.
Which is worse? The drippy kind or the metaphorical kind? I think
it depends on if you're getting dripped on.
Exactly.
I suppose we could look up on weather.com what the weather is like in Israel, where Dan Cohen, I believe, is right now or is on his way to right now. Perhaps if you're listening at home on a smartphone or something like that, you can quickly take a moment and look up what the weather is like in Israel. And while you're doing that, I think we'll just get started with talking about the news for late September, early October. Of course, the really big news is that 2 days ago, on October 5th, Steve Jobs passed away. I think we're not going to talk about this in depth, partly because we did already do a good bit of reflecting on the Steve Jobs legacy for higher education and education in general on the last two podcasts. So we'll refer you to episode 74 and to episode 73 if you want to spend some time thinking about Steve Jobs and education. We hope that what we said in those two podcasts might be of interest. But in general, of course, I think we're feeling what everybody is feeling, that he was a visionary, an amazing person, and that it's very sad that he's died so young at only 56. Tom and Mills, anything quick to add to that before we go on into other news?
No, just, you know, it's just really sad.
Yeah. I hadn't quite realized, I must say. I mean, people were saying that he had waged a very public battle with cancer. And I mean, although, I was aware that he was going through that, really still most of the news was about Apple and about the products. And I think that actually says something about his life, really, that even when he stepped down, you know, so much of the talk was about what's next for Apple. So in any case, we'll miss you, Steve Jobs. Rest in peace. Hope all is well where you are. And with that, we'll go on to some other news. One of the fairly big product releases, actually besides the iPhone 5, which I think we're not really even going to talk about much, maybe a little bit, but one of the
Because it's not the iPhone 5, it's the iPhone 4S.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
It wasn't really that big of an announcement.
So. S for substitute?
Right. I mean, it's sort of the news there was, you know, no news.
Is it iOS 5, though?
iOS 5 is coming out, yeah, in a couple of weeks. But I think that, you know, that was something that they had previewed in their last big announcement. They had previewed iOS 5, so that was expected. I think people were expecting new hardware, which they kind of got. There's, you know, they've kind of upped the specs on the iPhone. The 4S has a better camera and some, you know, better firmware and some, you know, faster processor and that kind of thing. But it's the same design. It's the same industrial design. It's the same case, same screen, same, you know, if you put two of them next to each other, you wouldn't really be able to tell the difference. And I think people were a little disappointed by that. But I think, you know, looking back at the events of the past week, it could actually, I think, have been that Apple was dealing with some bigger problems, with, you know, Steve Jobs, I think, was sicker than anybody realized when he stepped down last month. And so, I think it could, in some ways, I think it's kind of a, it would have been weird for them to make this big, giant iPhone 5 announcement, you know, with this awesome new hardware and sexy, you know, new ad campaign, and then a couple days later for Steve to pass. So I wonder if, you know, these stories aren't in some way connected.
I guess I would be a little surprised if they really were planning their product launches around Steve Jobs' health, but...
Well, it's not so much that. It's not that they plan it around his health, but that his health, you know, like, I think people were thinking that he was, like, a strong, you know, like, up until the last, you know, up until he stepped down, he was, like, you know, really driving the bus. And it's possible, since the time between he stepped down and the time he died, that actually he wasn't quite as involved, and there was more turmoil there, right, than there appeared to have been. And so, you know, that they maybe lost 6 months in the development cycle.
I'm going to agree with that, because, I mean, just as you were saying that, Tom, I was remembering what it was like at CH&M in the last months before Roy died, and we all kind of found it impossible to think during that period. And I think the same will be true at Apple, you know, shortly at, you know, over the next couple of months. It's just really hard to think.
Yeah, I was actually, like, thinking about Roy Rosenzweig, too. I never met him, wasn't working at the center when he passed, but it struck me that actually that Roy, you know, was the center in a very real way.
I've been thinking the same thing. In the 6 months that Roy was really sick, or 4 months that he was really sick, you know, we all worked, and we all worked hard. But there was a lot of putting off of big decisions. So, like, a decision about, you know, should, you know, how we should change the case of the iPhone, which for Apple is a huge decision. It may have been one of those things that it might have been just easier to punt on till next year, during that time. So, I mean, I don't think they were, like, making product decisions, you know, based on his health. But I just think, you know, I'm sure things are nuts there.
Right.
You know, more nuts than their marketing team lets on.
Well, it's funny. I, as I mentioned earlier to you guys before we started recording, my brother's birthday is coming up. And so I was thinking, oh, gee, maybe he might like a laptop, maybe a MacBook or something. We haven't decided that we're going to get him that. So in the unlikely event that my brother is listening, you know, don't think I've spoiled the surprise. But I went to the Apple store and was confronted with that picture of Steve Jobs and was just shocked, you know. And I'll tell you what, I certainly didn't feel like shopping after that. I mean, it immediately was all much more thinking about Steve Jobs than it was about the product. So even just on my silly little consumer-driven errand, I was definitely derailed. So I think you must be right, of course, that there things may be a little slow at Apple for a while now. I mean, the thing that I did hear about their recent announcement that people were talking about was this Siri assistant, the sort of voice-activated intelligent agent. And I've heard lots of good jokes about it, but I'm sort of not informed enough about it to really opine anything about it one way or another. I don't know if any of you guys have any particular thoughts about that. No one has tried it yet, really.
No, I think
Siri app, I think.
Yeah.
Tom and I are both Android guys too, right, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the Android universe, the response is like, oh yeah, we got that 3 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's this I think this is something that, like, you know, is covered all over the place, but I think that there's like a, you know, the technology press, I think, is, you know, like actually the academic community, it's like, and the digital humanities community, it's like very Apple heavy, you know, much, much more Apple centric than the rest of the market. And so, you know, tech journalists, when Apple makes an announcement, it becomes this huge thing, even if it's something that has kind of, it's kind of old news in the rest of the market. Now, that said, Apple often will take ideas, and people have said this about Steve Jobs in their memorials. They will often take ideas that have been implemented, you know, poorly or in a kind of humdrum way elsewhere, and make them, you know, a killer app. They'll make them work. They'll make them seamless. They'll make them, you know, awesome, insanely great. But I don't, but the first reaction I have, having an Android phone, having had an Android phone for about 4 years, is like, yeah, I've been doing voice activation in my car for a long time. And I've been doing, you know, speech to text, text messaging for a long time. So that's my kind of first reaction to that.
Wow, I want that. I didn't realize you could have that on Android.
Oh yeah, and always have. That's why, I mean, it's a Google product, and Google, you know, we've talked about before, Google had this Google 411 service, and they had been using that data to improve their speech to text recognition, and that launched in a real way when they launched Android. They took that data, all of that voice data, and implemented it as voice recognition in Android. So it is kind of cool, and I guess you'll get it with iOS 5.
Well, the gadget launch that really was a very meaty gadget launch in the last couple of weeks, though, unlike the Apple press conference, was the Kindle Fire. Amazon launched actually a new round of Kindles and their much-awaited tablet, the Kindle Fire. By the way, I should mention, 2 days ago, I stepped on my Kindle, like after the announcement. Not on purpose, mind you. I accidentally stepped on my current Kindle.
And?
Well, and nothing. And no, nothing has happened yet. I am currently Kindle-less. But
So you mean you really stepped on it?
I really stepped on it accidentally. I put
right.
it, you know, I was reading in bed. I put it on the floor next to my bed as I was falling asleep. And then in the morning, stumbling out of bed to get that first cup of coffee, I stepped on my Kindle. So it's actually, I didn't step on it very hard, but it's got, you know, like a little cracked screen. So I have to say, I have been looking at the Kindle.
I have done this before. I have dropped my phone just by mistake, just as the new phone that I wanted came out, and been forced. I have done this, and my wife insists that I've done it a couple of times, and my wife insists that it's subconscious, and that I'm destroying my current product, so I'm forced to go buy the new one. So I wonder, Amanda, I wonder if
well,
it really
what,
was
what
an
I
accident.
Wonder is which Kindle my subconscious is trying to get me to buy. Because right. So, and I should probably summarize the story a little bit. I mean, for those who don't know, in the unlikely event that you don't know, the Kindle Fire is the tablet. It's a 7-inch tablet. It's full color touch tablet. And again, one of the big pieces of news was that it's only $199. I mean, that's insane. That's a really cheap price.
It's almost cheap given what's on the market.
Given what's on the market. And this obviously makes it very attractive for education, even at the secondary school level. And it'll be interesting to see whether this really gets adopted in, you know, by educators as something, you know, a way to deliver more kinds of content than just textbooks. But they did also release a new round of increasingly inexpensive sort of regular Kindles. There's the Kindle Touch. Many people have said, oh gosh, I've been used to my iOS devices and I can touch them and I hate that the Kindle doesn't have a touch screen and the Nook had a touch screen. Well, they did announce a Kindle Touch. But they also announced sort of, I really like that they kind of kept the regular e-ink Kindle. You can get it with a keyboard still. And that is as low as $79, although for $79 you basically have to get what are essentially ads on that version of the Kindle. But the
ads are really innocuous. They're only on that kind of screensaver. It's like screensaver ads. Once you turn the thing on, there are no ads.
Really?
It's really, yeah.
That is pretty tempting, but it's only $109, I think, or $100 right. for...
No ads.
Without the ads.
Yeah. And then there's the one without the keyboard, right? There's just the little one, which is not touch, no keyboard, and it's like super cheap, right?
The e-ink one that is not a touch one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how much was the Kindle when it first came out?
I mean,
it was like $300.
Yeah, it was like $399.
I think.
Well, here's the answer to your question, Amanda. You want both. You want.
Oh, no.
One of the e-ink ones, probably the little teeny one. Yeah, probably you probably don't need the touch, just for like reading books.
Reading
and then
in
you
bed.
Want the Kindle Fire as a tablet, which is more of a multimedia device. It allows you to do email. You can read. It does full color magazines well and that kind of thing. See, this is the thing: is I haven't bought a tablet yet, not because I'm an Apple hater, although I sort of am, but mainly because I couldn't justify having, you know, I really like my Kindle for reading, just for, you know, straight out reading in bed. I love it. But I couldn't justify having one device for reading that costs $150 and another device for, you know, toying around with in front of the TV for $499. I mean, I just couldn't justify having $500 plus of like little gadgets in addition to my phone. But at $199 and $79, that starts to seem like a real possibility that I could have both of these things. And I think that's actually what Amazon is shooting for. They're saying to you, you need this one device for reading, you know, your spy novels and this other device for reading Newsweek magazine. And at these prices, you can start to think about having both.
That is not a bad point at all, Tom. That's actually a really good point. And what's interesting about that is there was a good bit of deathmatch-type discourse back when the iPad launched about, like, which would survive, which would be the last man standing, the kind of e-ink, e-readers, or the tablet. And clearly, since Amazon is producing both, they think there's room for both.
Yeah. I mean, when the e-ink thing is $50... which it's, you know, I mean, as soon as this holiday season's over, I'm sure they'll drop them down again. I mean, then it becomes like, I mean, think of what all the things you buy for $50, you know, like $50 is, it's an impulse purchase. It's not a, you know, it's no longer a big decision. It's something, you know, you buy. And so, you know, right now buying a tablet versus a Kindle versus a Nook versus, you know, all these things, you know, it's a decision. But when you start getting into the $70, $50, $40 price range, it's no longer it's not a decision you make. It's just something you happen to go, you know, on a Saturday buy. Just like you buy a shirt. You know, it's not like this huge decision. Should I buy this new shirt? You know, you want a shirt, you buy a shirt. I actually think this announcement like totally changes the economics of this market
and
throws things into question.
What's so sort of fascinating and brilliant about it, maybe not completely fascinating, but what's brilliant about it is that Amazon sells you the content. You know, it's vertically integrated, to use that business speak. You know, they're almost certainly taking a loss on this hardware, a financial loss, because they're making it up in the content that they're selling you through these devices. And I can't help but think that they may have, you know, learned a little something from Steve Jobs and Apple there. You know, I mean,
well, and I'm actually going to back it up a full step and say it's not really that they learned it from Steve Jobs. It's that they learned it from the disposable razor industry, which is how this all started. I mean, it is. It's how, you know, this was the first product that was designed to just sell. So they would give you the nice razor so that you had to buy the blades. And before that, men had razor blades that they sharpened on those razor strops. And then all of a sudden, they were buying disposable razor blades. And I guess it was Mr. Gillette who became wildly wealthy as a result. So, you know, and when was the last time you spent more for a printer than for a year's worth of toner? And you know, the whole technology industry is based on this razor blade model.
Yeah. Interesting footnote to that Gillette story is that Gillette actually wasn't the guy who came up with the idea. It was his partner. And he had a partner in the firm, and this is totally off topic. But actually, the Boston University stadium is named for this guy. His name was Nickerson, and he was actually the founding partner. But the two of them decided that they were going to call the company Gillette because Nickerson was a bad name for a razor company.
That's good.
Isn't that good?
That's very good.
It's never a waste of time to learn the history.
Exactly.
That's, right. That's what you get.
Exactly.
When you start.
So then the last footnote I would say, Amanda, I'm going to agree with Tom. You need to buy both because it will also be good for America, because you will therefore spend the extra money and help stimulate the economy at this time of a possible double dip recession. So it will also be the patriotic choice.
Well, that settles it.
So you see, you can just go to, as soon as we're done recording, you can log on to Amazon and stimulate the economy.
Yes, well, we'll see. Maybe you guys should stimulate my paycheck a little bit.
Yeah, you'll have to talk to Tom about that.
Okay, all right. I'm going to skulk away.
So we have just a couple of other stories that we wanted to touch on. Including, I wanted to do a little reporting from a meeting that I went to a couple of weeks ago. I couldn't resist going just a few blocks away from my apartment in Capitol Hill to the NEH Project Directors meeting. The NEH, of course, is the National Endowment for the Humanities. They are in the old post office building in downtown Washington, D.C. And I went to a really terrific meeting at the end of September, which was basically just a bunch of dork shorts, a lightning round, a bunch of two-minute presentations from NEH grantees. Most of the presenters were telling us about their projects that had been funded by the Startup Grant Program, which was a terrific program that Brett Bobley, the director of the NEH Office of Digital Humanities, began. And kind of what was really new and unusual and useful about it was that those startup grants were less money, instead of being, you know, really big amounts of money. So many of the presenters had gotten that grant. Many of them had gotten larger grants. Some of the presenters had gotten funding for advanced institutes. The NEH, if you're interested in learning how to be a digital humanist, you could do far worse than to go to the website of NEH.gov and browse through the advanced institutes on the Office of Digital Humanities section of that site, because they will, you know, send you to learn about GIS for a couple of weeks and things like that. So it's a little hard for me to maybe summarize everything that I learned there, because it was so so relaxing and so lovely just to sit back in the audience and be entertained by all the amazing things that people are doing, and to have it last only 2 minutes, you know, which is about the length of my attention span these days given how much time I spend on the internet. So I guess I'd just trace a couple of themes there. Many of the participants talked about the importance, you know, many of them were essentially making digital collections available, and particular collections, and those of them who were doing that were often talking about setting up linked open data. And I think Brett Bobley, in an interview he gave to Inside Higher Ed, did a great job of explaining what that is and explaining the importance of it. Brett pointed out that while, you know, what linked open data is actually a sort of a complicated technical infrastructure that you don't need to go into what that is. But the effect of it is to allow researchers to share data that can deepen the context for everybody. So just as, you know, the web linked things through hyperlinks, linked data can create all kinds of new opportunities for new knowledge. If somebody has some historic data and somebody has some demographic data and other people have climate data, you can merge all those data sets if they're kind of described in a fairly standard way and derive new knowledge from them. So many of the projects were dealing with that. Games. There were a couple of people developing games that were quite interesting. The two that got a lot of attention were Desperate Fishwives, which was early modern history. Excuse me. Getting people to understand what it was like to live in essentially, you know, the early Renaissance. There was another game called Pox and the City, which I've actually mentioned on this podcast before, which is an epidemiological game in which you get to play the disease or the doctor or a person affected by the disease. One of my favorite projects was actually a museum-centered project in Milwaukee. I believe it's called it's one of the major museums in Milwaukee. I've forgotten the name, but they have a couple of Egyptian mummies, which back in the 80s they took CAT scans of because the AT&T labs were not too far away. And they're actually using those CAT scans to create holograms of the mummies that you'll be able to look at and interact with when you go and visit the museum. So that was pretty amazing and cool. A couple of the other projects were things that I don't necessarily understand too much about, but I'm always interested to hear about, things like linguistic corpora analysis. I always enjoy doing that. There was the Rural Alaska Cultural Media Project, which was basically about teaching rural Alaskan teachers to teach their students to do multimedia documentaries about their lives. That kind of thing is really, really interesting. So there were just a lot of great projects, I think one of the things I got from it was just that there were so many. There were over 50 projects, 2 minutes a piece. There's probably more like 100 projects, including sort of really well-known ones like the New York Public Library's project for crowdsourcing transcription of its historic menus, which is a really fun little thing to go and do. But there were so many people doing so many really interesting and different things that it was great to see it in action. So if you are interested in learning more about that, you can always go to the Office of Digital Humanities website on neh.gov and learn more about the kind of projects that they fund.
I mean, one of the things I find really interesting about what Brett has done with the Office of Digital Humanities is, and I mean, it's sort of a chicken and egg kind of situation. I don't know which came first. I think it's probably a little of both. But he has managed to build a community around his granting programs. Like, there isn't really a community in the division of public projects at NEH or the research division at NEH. Like, they don't get together. The grantees, I don't think they get together and think of themselves as a community. But the grantees in the ODH programs, I think, really do. And that, I think, in part, it's like, we always say, digital humanities is this great community that sort of, unlike other communities in the humanities, we have a real sense of solidarity and community. And I think Brett has built on that, but also, reinforced it with the work he's done in bringing, that community even closer together through the grant programs, but then through connecting those grantees to each other. And so it's really, I mean, this kind of thing is, it's pretty different from what, you know, the rest of NEH and certainly NSF and these other funding organizations have done. And I think Brett deserves a lot of credit for that.
Brett deserves a lot of credit for everything.
Yeah, I would agree with what Tom said on that. I mean, it's really something that we've needed so badly, and without any kind of, you know, directive from the NEH or from Congress or any other thing, Brett kind of decided, I think, on his own that he was going to use this opportunity of these grants to create this kind of community of digital humanists, and it exists now largely as a result of his efforts.
Well, I guess I hadn't quite realized that this was that unusual. I didn't realize that maybe the NEH Department of Preservation and Access doesn't have meetings to get its project directors together.
I mean, there are some things like that. But it's not, I think they do occasionally get together and they have invitational things where they hold a seminar or they bring in a speaker, or, you know, there are some things like that. And IMLS has WebWise, which I think is similar in that way. But I don't think they are conferences that they hold. They're gatherings, but they're not like community building events in the way that Brett has set up his events. I think they're more like, you know, sort of just standard research presentations. Whereas this is much more about really community building. And so it is different, I think, than what the other divisions have done and what,
it would have been very easy to set this meeting up so that you had a couple of featured projects, and they were the only ones who got to talk, you know, and maybe there were, you know, resources for learning more about the other presentations, you know, or the other projects, but you maybe didn't learn as much about them. And I mean, what I really loved about this 2-minute lightning round presentation format, as difficult as it can be sometimes to stick within it, is just that it put everybody on the same level. And it's just like, project, 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 project. And you just walk away from the whole thing with just such a sense of plenitude. I don't think I've done nearly as good a job as I could of just, you know, explaining all the different things I saw, but it was such a sort of a phantasmagoria of interesting projects that people are doing that it was just hard to even kind of take it all in. But they were all, you know, equally valued in some way. You know, like, it's just as important to maybe teach rural Alaskan teachers how to make multimedia documentaries as it is to support linked open data at the Ancient World Institute at New York University. You know, I mean, the humanities just covers so much that it's really great to get that breadth and that equivalence. And I guess as a sort of a philosophy in general, these people who say that, you know, being online, being digital, living digital, you know, isolates you from other people, it always seems to me so wrong, because when I'm online all day and I'm sort of interacting with people virtually, it makes me want to see them in person more. And it means that when I do see them in person, we have really rich interactions. And as a sort of a side note, this is kind of one of the reasons why I have a mild but strong belief that the Digital Public Library should actually have a building. You need to have a place where people can meet, because if people are interacting with things online, that doesn't replace the physical. It never replaces the physical. It makes the physical more valuable if you do it right. I mean, even going back to Steve Jobs, Steve Jobs did Apple stores at a time when people were convinced that you couldn't do computer stores. And Apple stores have been hugely, hugely successful. And I mean, the notion that just because you're interacting with people digitally all the time, or that you're communicating with people digitally, the notion that replaces being able to go somewhere and see people in person is just wrong, I think. Well, let's move on to just a few other stories. I don't think we have too much time yet. But Mills, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about an interesting story that was a small story about this social media blackout that Harrisburg University did?
Yeah, it was the Harrisburg University of Science, and they had a sort of a brief blackout of all social media on campus and last year, and now they've had a chance to go back and sort of look at how students and faculty and others reacted to it. The story was actually from last month's Inside Higher Ed, but the what I found was really interesting was that before the blackout happened, a third of the students thought this was a really bad idea, and slightly less than a quarter thought it was a good idea. But afterwards, 42% of the students thought it was something that it was good to do, and only 16% thought it was a bad idea. Now, the author of the story points out that lots of students, you know, they were blocked from the university's network. They weren't blocked from using their smartphones to check Facebook and that kind of thing. But they still responded positively to this brief period of time when they were cut off from all the distractions around them, digital distractions around them, or at least partially cut off. And, you know, I'm somebody who, like I think all of us, I have the same problem. And so I've been using, you know, one of the multiple choices out there, something called Antisocial, created by Fred Stutzman down at the University of North Carolina, so that when I'm writing on a deadline, I just cut myself off from email and blogs and all those other things. And so it does make you more productive, and or at least help you be more productive. So it doesn't make you, I guess, but it does help you. But I think it's just very interesting that the results of this study of how the students reacted, because it does show that they do understand that there are distractions out there, lots of digital distractions, and it's nice to get removed from them once in a while. So maybe exam week would be a good time, for instance.
Yeah, and what I loved about this story, too, was that so many universities might, I mean, I don't think any university would dare to do this as a matter of policy, but some high schools and some other educational institutions will do pieces of this. You know, there are plenty of workplaces, plenty of schools that will block Facebook and YouTube, just, you know, wholesale. And instead, what this university did, I love these sort of campus-wide teaching moments, and there are so few campuses, it seems, where you can arrange that sort of thing. I remember reading a while ago after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita happened that there was a university that devoted an entire day, basically, to teaching disasters. They said, hey, let's take all of the classes that are happening all across the institution and see if you can focus on, you know, disasters and reactions to disasters, you know, based on the content of your course. It was a sort of a teach-in day about Katrina and sort of related things. So I remember reading about an ancient history class where, you know, they talked about Vesuvius exploding and, you know, what, you know, can we look at that? What was that like, you know, in comparison to the Katrina disaster, that sort of thing. So I just love these sort of university-wide educational moments because it takes education seriously as an institutional matter rather than it's just something that a professor does getting up and blathering in front of a class. It's something that the university is responsible for. That's what I loved about it.
Yeah, it was, you know, I think it was just a really great experience for the students because it gave them an opportunity to reflect on the role of all this technology in their lives. And, you know, is it going to change their behavior substantially? Of course not. But it does at least get them to think about it a little bit. And, you know, those of us who live here in the greater Washington area, we have lots of friends and colleagues and neighbors who don't find this kind of thing surprising at all because they work in buildings with various levels of security where, you know, they can't bring a smartphone into work. They can't bring a phone with a camera on it into work. It's kind of hard to find a phone without a camera anymore. But if their phone, if the only cell phone they own is one with a camera on it, they have to leave it in their car during their work hours. And so, you know, these kinds of secure facilities around here, ranging from courthouses, you know, pretty minimal security to, you know, ultra secret places that nobody wants to talk about, you know, adults, grown-ups at work are regularly cut off from all of this kind of thing.
Well, I think it's such an interesting generational thing too, because if you have kids who are 18, they may never have may never really be able to remember a time when they didn't have social networking. You know, maybe not everybody my age has the same experience, but I actually have very little trouble turning off from social media when I want to. In fact, I usually do on weekends and evenings, actually. I just kind of shut it off. And I've always thought that that's partly just a generational thing, because it's almost a nostalgia. You know, I'm going back to that time before there was social media. Not that I don't enjoy it. Of course I enjoy it. That's why I do it. But, you know, for people, you know, who are swimming in that and have been since birth, you might need to artificially create that environment that doesn't have the social networking in it.
Well, and can I just say, Amanda, welcome to middle age.
Oh, I know. I have been welcomed to it. Well, I think that's about all we have time for today. But thank you, Tom and Mills, for joining me. And we'll talk to you again on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.